Bob's 330 rule. It goes like this. If you can't finish your question to the mic and you have to use the mic, in 30 seconds I get the mic back. If he can't finish his answer in 30 minutes, 3 minutes.
No problem.
3 minutes. Yeah. Actually, that's the reason I'm doing this. Most lecturers can't answer a question less than 3 minutes. So, 30 seconds, 3 minutes. If you have a question, raise your hand, and I am going to be timing you.
And by the way, for some of the folks that asked me last night, I didn't talk about it here. I do, in the Human Advantage, talk about the future of agriculture, and it's complicated. And so I do actually talk, I make some very specific predictions about what I think is actually going to happen in the next 20 years.
No questions.
Yeah, over here. Dr. Richards, just how prevalent is the total ignoring, of God throughout our university college systems?
In all
areas of study.
Yeah. It's a little complicated, but I've got 30 seconds. And so what I'll say is that at the level of what's officially assumed, it's almost total in the university system. I'm not excluding Christian colleges. Now, of course, if they have faith statements and things, there's going to be kind of the trappings of faith, but they're still, everybody's taught in the same schools. And so this kind of assumption of materialism is almost total at that level. If you look at polls, though, of faculty members, interestingly enough, like in the natural sciences, about half of mathematicians and physicists believe in God. And so the harder sciences and mathematics tend to be more God-friendly. And then the human sciences, the humanities, psychology, and sociology, they're just hotbeds of materialism. And so if you're in economics or engineering or physics, weirdly enough, a kid is less likely to have to get this stuff jammed down his throat than if he's in sociology or something. So,
by the way, before I forget it, the audios for these sessions will be on our website before you get to lunch. So.
You presented great information last night and today, and much different, I believe. Is there an overarching theme that you're wanting us to come away with or think about?
Absolutely. And it's right at what I say at the end. The most important economic fact and the most important fact about technology is that human beings are creatures made in the image of God. We're bodily, right? But we're also spiritual and rational and intelligent. That is the most important economic fact. And in this 1991 encyclical called Certes Humanae, Pope John Paul II said, after the land, the greatest resource that man has is man himself. It is our ideas and our purposes and our capacities and our virtues that both is important economically and that distinguishes us forever from machines. That's the key thing.
Sir, could you give us your top 5 suggested readings?
Oh gosh, that's an impossible. Money, Greed, and God. No, Actually,
last night, Tom, I told people that they couldn't get to heaven because they didn't read that book.
Actually,
there was kind of a back row for people that were kind of like the dummies, economics for dummies.
I do have, though, suggested readings in the back of the Human Advantage. And if there's a copy there, you can look. On these kind of economics and technology pieces, I was at a conference a few days ago that I was a part of for the second memorial symposium on Michael Novak, who is a Christian economic thinker. And my good friend and sometime collaborator George Gilder spoke. I have essentially patterned my career in trying to extend Michael Novak's argument and translate the work of George Gilder. Because George Gilder is kind of a tough writer. But he has a new book called Life After Materialism. Life After Google just came out. And a book a few years ago called Knowledge and Power, which are kind of the theoretical foundations of much of what I say. So those are very, very important. Almost anything, if you're interested in the kind of technology and economics, is George Gilder is the place to start. But he doesn't do what I do. I try to write I actually do this. I rewrite until I get the prose to an eighth grade level. George does whatever he can to write, I guess, for himself. And so it's a little more challenging. So I, the whole career just translating him.
By the way, we are getting carried. In September, we'll have the new version of Money, Greed, and God. And it sounds like it's going to be even better. And Mike Woods, where are you? Mike and I had a conversation 4 or 5 years ago. He said, I'm going to read that book every year.
Yeah, Dr. Richards, couldn't help but not notice this week the picture of AOC with ashes on her forehead.
Yes.
Why do you care? Yeah, I have my own opinion, but
yeah.
Would you care to comment on why, you know, especially a church that has taught against socialism,
yeah.
Why so many Christians seem to be disposed to it?
Well, it's because of this stuff I talked about last night, is that we don't know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Right? So when Pius XI talked about socialism, he was talking about this totalitarian system in which all private property and all private institutions are subsumed into the state. Mm-hmm. Right? That's not compatible with any kind of Christianity. But if socialism, you just mean, well, I just think we should have a society where everybody's afforded a basic level of dignity. Well, okay.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I spend so much time saying, force people to talk about the actual thing and not their mental pictures, because it is impossible to defend that kind of thing if you do that. Now, unfortunately, AOC and other people, they're still in this country. We're still generally a religious country. So that even people that are rabidly pro-abortion, like the Speaker of the House, still try to get whatever mileage they can off of their appearing to be religious. It's still bad for politicians. Right, to be hardcore atheists. In fact, Bernie Sanders has had a hard time kind of saying what his religious views are. So it shows you that at one level, we're running on the fumes of a religious past. But if you want to find out where we're probably going, just look to Europe, in which in many countries, at least in Northern Europe, there's absolutely no social advantage to being religious.
I don't think I need that.
It needs to be recorded, though, so that's, yeah.
You said something about agriculture.
Yes.
Could you comment briefly where you think it's going?
Yeah, very briefly, and so it's complicated. So everyone assumes that because things become more and more automated, that everything becomes a commodity and it's more and more produced by robots, right? And so if you look at what's happened in farming, though, I don't know how many of you are farmers, but if any of you are large farmers, do you have auto steer on your tractor?
Most people do.
Most people do, exactly. And that's where we're going, right? And so, and because, you know, when you're sitting behind the tractor, that's actually fairly easily automated, right? It's a lot easier to automate than a taxi driving around downtown Seattle. And yet we've automated that already, right? Tesla already has long-haul trucks that can run themselves across the interstates. Those jobs are get automated in fairly short order. So does that mean that all agriculture is eventually going to be, everything we eat is going to be in hydroponic farms, inside, you know, in deserts, you know, under tarps, monitored by autonomous drones? No. And in fact, you can already see this happening. What's happening is a differentiation of the agricultural sector. And so on the one hand, we're becoming ever more automated, right? And so most of the actual non-local produce that's eaten in the EU is actually grown in these hydroponic farms in the deserts of Spain that is almost entirely automated. And yet, I was talking to a man last night in Washington, D.C. Do you know almost everyone with it's an upper middle class, they go out of their way and will spend 4 and 5 times as much on produce and meat and eggs that's locally and organically grown, right? Just because, well, I've got disposable income and I'm interested in how the animals are treated and I'd rather them be grown organically and I want them to be grown near me so I can even know the name of the farmer. I know this sounds like maybe a Portlandia skit to you, but this is what's happening. And so there are all these small, what I call this bespoke labor, highly specialized, highly touch intensive types of labor, and that market is growing dramatically. And so what I think is going to happen, it's the same thing if you think about coffee. Right, in 1960, if you thought about automation, you'd say, you know, in the 2000s, people will probably just spend 2 cents on coffee as coffee production and roasting, right, gets cheaper and cheaper. And we could. It's never been cheaper, you know, in terms of a commodity. And yet at Catholic University, we have a Starbucks on campus, we have a Starbucks in the bookstore across the street, and across the street from that, we have a Starbucks Reserve, which is the super expensive, super fussy Starbucks, and it's always hopping. What are people doing? As coffee became a commodity, we got more and more interested in highly specialized forms of the things. And so what I think is going to happen is that there's going to continue this massive commodification and automation of large-scale farming, and that what's going to crop up is this kind of post-commodification, post-automated agricultural era in which people get more and more interested in the specialized kind of farming, pampered pork and stuff like that. So that's already happening. And so I've got a piece in the Wall Street Journal in July that kind of proposes this theory. So that's
and if you read his book,
yeah.
You'll see that that kind of specialization in a lot of different ways is part of the answer to it, why it's not going to all be robots.
That's
right. Questions?
I work a lot with college students on college campuses, and some things I hear when talking about socialism is, you know, I think a lot of them do want it out of a good heart. They genuinely
absolutely
want equality for all.
Yeah.
How would you talk to someone without you seeming like you're on a high horse to try to get them off their high horse?
Right,
how
exactly.
How would you do that without
alienating them? Absolutely. And that's why I say, when I was talking about the art of economics yesterday.
Real softball question.
It's so total softball. Is that the art of economics consists in not snapping at people. It consists in saying, well, and then what would happen? Right? That, if you say that in the right tone, that's very unassuming. You're actually asking them. Think about it yourself. Right? And so you're exactly right. I always assume that the motives of people are good. Now, I think sometimes politicians advocate policies even though they know they're not good because it will give them power. But I think the ordinary college kid that's thinking they like socialism is almost certainly liking it because of this mental image that seems pleasing. And so a person's moral intuitions can be exactly right, and their economic views and prescriptions can be completely wrong because they don't understand economic reality. And so that's why I try to encourage, by careful questioning, the kind of emergence of this art of economics in the thinking of the person who's saying this. Because the great thing about economic policy is it's all been tried. It's not speculative. There is an answer that will tell you what is going to happen for almost any policy in 10 seconds on Google, if you know how to search. And so just asking, okay, now, I understand why you would say that, right? Okay, let's raise the minimum wage to $200 an hour. And so what do you think would happen, right? And the answer, and then you say, okay, so what is it possible something else could happen, right? And then you can kind of slowly teach them price functions, supply and demand, and that kind of stuff, without them feeling like they're getting badgered. That's hard. That is a virtue that I have to work on and we all have to work on, especially if like you're an academic and an intellectual and you've worked the argument out and you can see where the argument's going and you know it's a dead end and you know it's idiotic. And you want to, it's like, let me stop you because I know where you're going and it's a dead end. Very often what you do is you have to restrain yourself and let the person work it out for themselves, even though you know that they're going to end up in a dead end. That's a spiritual virtue. That's not my job. I specialize. Yeah.
A lot of this comes down to asking really simple, good questions. Like,
oh, I would recommend tactics.
No.
You're supposed to ask it.
How did you come to that conclusion?
Yeah.
Where did you get that information?
Yeah. Simple.
Yeah.
There was something.
You come from the perspective of truth that is coherent,
right?
And with all the things around us, and is correspondent with reality.
That's right.
From Robert Zacharias's several talks, how do you deal from this perspective with what we're dealing with now? In a post-truth
right.
culture where we're dealing with what is my truth, mm-hmm. not the truth, but my truth,
yeah,
and therefore dealing with reason and so on.
Well, it's a matter of, first of all, if you're actually like in a public argument with someone, I'll do a debate next Wednesday, I think I told you guys last night, with a socialist. My job's not to persuade him, right? My job is to persuade the rational 18-year-old fence sitter that overhears it.
Yeah.
Right, and so it's like a defense attorney, she can never think, okay, my job is to convince the judge and the prosecuting attorney. That's not her job. Her job is to convince the jury, right? And so it's always important to realize that. And so you might have someone who is insisting that, well, there is no truth with capital T's, there's only my truth, right? You're not going to be able to necessarily persuade him that he's asserting a truth, right? You can say, okay, well, that's your truth. My truth is that there is absolute truth, right? You're not going to persuade him because he's actually trapped in a mental box, probably, if the person's that far gone, right? But there are people overhearing it who can recognize that, in fact, that guy's denying the correspondence theory of the truth, truth, and he's presupposing in order to make his argument. And so he's both denying it and affirming it at the same time. And so most people, because remember, Paul says in Romans that the law is written on the human heart. There is still a natural law. There are still natural realities that we are embedded in. There is still mammalian biology, right? And it doesn't care about your feelings. It just is what it is. And so remember that. If you have reality on your side, your job is to persuade the rational fence sitters. If the job is to persuade the most hardened skeptic, then there's no good argument for anything. Fortunately, that's not our job. And that's just a formula for, you know, kind of depression and despair. And so I always think, okay, I want to put this so that a reasonably rational person sitting on the fence will find my argument more persuasive than the other.
And Jay, you have not told us. I want to listen Wednesday night, and you haven't told me how to do that.
Oh, that's all right. So if you want to, it's live streamed. That's right. And I should have pulled up the website, but if you just Google this, it's at Notre Dame. It's at the Notre Dame website. I think it's like notredame.edu. It's called, Is It Time to Give Socialism a Chance? It will be 7 p.m. Eastern. So that's 5 p.m. here. That's not an optimal time. But if you want to watch it live, it's at 5 p.m. So just Google that, Jay Richards Notre Dame debate. It's Wednesday night at 7 p.m. It will be live streamed.
Last question.
Jay, by the way, thank you. You were fantastic. Really appreciate it. Say, I was struck by the your illustration of the, you have to do this, 30 seconds, the exponential growth of the information economy.
Yes.
And yet, the growth of wealth in the economy has not been exponential. And even just the growth of technology has been, I suppose, in general, has been almost exponential. But why is it, would you say that, is it because of just the growth of government, the overburden of interventionist government that's counteracting
great question.
What should be an exponential growth?
Yeah, there's several things, but notice I'm talking about the exponential growth is only in particular sectors, in the digital sector. So we don't have information or exponential growth in, say, energy efficiency, right? There's no Moore's law of energy we can extract from sunlight or from oil or something like that. Those are constrained by the laws of physics and chemistry. But the laws of information are different. And so when things are in the digital realm, they can have these weird properties, right? They're non-rival, you don't deplete the resource and those kinds of things. So the exponential growth is in that digital realm, which is only part of the economy. But it does affect all parts of the economy. So that's part of it. The other thing you have to remember is that the growth of the administrative state it's continued unabated. So just during President Obama's two terms, we added $1 trillion in regulations. So these are things that are kind of off books. You don't see it in terms of taxes. You don't see it in terms of economic growth. It's just lard on the economy, basically, dragging it down. $1 trillion just in an 8-year period. And so, you know, I mean, the growth of the regulatory state has continued until very recently. In the last few years, there's actually been some slowing. And so that's part of the problem. But the other thing is that the growth of the information economy is very hard to measure. And so most of the GDP, that we're really good at measuring how many barrels of oil were sold, how much did it cost, how many bushels of wheat were sold, how much did it cost, what were the transactions. That's what those macroeconomic statistics tell you. We don't have a way of measuring the value of the fact that you carry between $80,000 and $800,000 worth of capacities on this thing, most of which are basically free once you pay for the phone and your subscription. We don't know how to measure that. And so what's going to happen is that, and there's several economists trying to come up with better measures, one's called gross output, to capture all the growth in the digital economy, but we don't actually know how to measure it. So all we can measure is like technology stocks or something like that. But measuring the price of a technology stock is not the same as measuring the actual value to people of a particular technology. And so as this becomes more ethereal and more informational and less physical, we're going to have to come up with new ways of actually measuring our growth. But I mean, think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, in which you've got food at the bottom, health and safety, right, the kind of psychological well-being, and then he was a humanist, so he had self-actualization at the top. But you couldn't self-actualize, or you think of it philosophically, you couldn't have time and this leisure to read the great books until you have a place to sleep, until you're getting health care taken care of and food. Those things are all getting filled in. Right? And so what's going to happen in more and more advanced economies is that we're going to spend more of our activity up here in this informational realm. And so we're going to have to find a way to measure it. So I'd say it's hard to measure, and we're sort of stymieing the growth of the regulatory state simultaneously.
I missed this gentleman. We're going to have one quick question and one quick answer, and then
that was more than 30 seconds, I know, sorry.
Thanks, Dick. Sorry, it's a quick question, but it's got two parts. So, do you think that we're reaching a tipping point or a critical mass between the industrial age and this information age? And then the second part of that question is, do you think that that could possibly lead to a depression that might actually, like the Great Depression we saw in 1929?
Yeah. I think if you look at the Depression, what the Depression was it was a recession that was made into a depression by bad government policy. And so we still have actually a very productive economy. It's just doing things differently. And so there is going to be disruption. I don't think there's any reason to think that, at least in the technological sector, we're going to reach a tipping point. I mean, like at the moment, manufacturing is not going to totally disappear. It's going to become more automated. It's also going to become more productive. So there are going to be entire sectors of the economy that are going to become obsolete. That just, you know, it's not, I'm not saying that to celebrate it or to disparage it. I just think that's a reality. And so what, if you're doing mental work that can be easily automated or physical work that can be easily automated, have a plan B. On the other hand, notice nobody's, robots aren't going to replace the gardener and the housekeeper and the landscaper anytime soon. We don't have machines that can do those things, those complex bodily things. And so things like, say, truck driving, long-haul truck driving, I think is going to be in deep trouble, at least long-term, maybe 10 or 15 or 20 years out. That's bad for men, especially in Western states, many of whom that's their job. On the other hand, there are lots of things you can do with your body in the skilled trades. There are between 4 and 5 million skilled trade jobs right now that are unfilled because nobody trains for them anymore. And so there's going to be plenty of physical labor and there's going to be plenty of mental work to do. It's going to take changing, though, with the climate. And I think that's what we want to focus on. What set of policies can we come up with to make the transition easier?
I want to say, plan on being with us in September. Help us. We had 40 people signed up as of Wednesday. That's why we were a little overburdened last night. If you can sign up earlier, that helps. You are a great bunch of people. Thank you for coming. What do you think? There you go. Have a great day and share the audio with somebody.